Ahmoudou. Welcome to Health Chat. We continue to look at the COVID-19 pandemic today. As of July 7th, nearly 500,000 people have been infected in Africa with the novel coronavirus. More than 11,000 have lost their lives and over 260,000 have recovered. This week, we bring you part two of the special edition of Straight Talk Africa as experts look at the impact of the coronavirus pandemic in Africa and the way forward. Take a listen. Our guests are Dr. Karisha Abdul-Karim, Associate Scientific Director of CAPRISA, Center for the AIDS Program of Research in South Africa. Dr. Ahmed Ogwel Uma is Deputy Director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the Africa CDC. Jeremy Zungrana is Country Director of JPIGO, Burkina Faso, and Aaron Betrou is Managing Director of the Center for Financial Markets with Milken Institute. Professor Karisha, I wanted to come to you first and have your reaction. We heard during the break these different voices on COVID-19. There was a mother that was infected and she was concerned for her daughter. Would you speak to the fact that when people are sick and they are home, being treated home, how should they properly protect their loved ones?
Yeah, this is a very important issue, as I mentioned earlier, about the living conditions for many people in Africa is quite constrained in terms of number of people within a household and also where we have women who are the main healthcare providers on the continent, in addition to being first responders. So beyond healthcare work, things like cashiers at supermarkets and shopping malls and so on. And this has caused immense challenges and is very troubling for women who have families, and when they come back, will they be infecting them and so on. So one of the calls, which is, you know, can there be other isolation facilities? And it may sound like a bit of a luxury, but I think in homes where many people and the possibility of self-isolation is not possible, I think government interventions for those facilities are important. But at the end of the day, I think the things we have in our hands is what we know, which is about frequent hand sanitizing the surfaces and environments we living and working in. It's about the social distancing as far as it's possible. It's about the use of masks on a regular basis. And those things are things that will help us to minimize spread and not only protect ourselves, but protect people who are close and near to us in the workplace or at home.
Okay. And Dr. Uma, one of the voices was speaking on protection for healthcare workers. What is being done to help healthcare workers on the continent? We've seen that this pandemic has really affected many of them who even lost their lives.
We are doing three key things in as far as protecting healthcare workers on the continent is concerned. First is building their knowledge on how to handle a highly infectious disease like COVID-19. And that we are doing directly, and we are doing it online. We're using every possible means to ensure that the healthcare workers' capacity is built in as far as protecting themselves is concerned. Second is we are providing them with appropriate personal protective equipment. And these we are sourcing wherever we source globally, and we are making them available at country level. And many countries are now starting to do local production and making the personal protective equipment even more easily available. Finally is to ensure that we are advising governments to separate the regular health services from COVID-related health services. And this is important so that we do not have other health services being affected because people are either afraid to go to the health facility or indeed healthcare workers are afraid to work in an environment where there is COVID-19. So if you separate the facilities, then you can be able to manage the issues of infection prevention and control much more easily. Of the many things we are doing, some of the three key things to try and reduce spread amongst healthcare workers and keep our health system running, because we have very few of those healthcare workers.
Okay. And Aaron, Africa's growth, Africa's economic growth is projected to fall drastically. And this is going to be the first recession in the region for the past 25 years. GDP is expected to fall between 3 to 8%, according to some projection. Now, we see that small and medium businesses will be dramatically affected, and it's difficult for them to recover from this. So what can be done to help SMBs?
Well, you bring up a good point. So essentially, it's a bit of a twin set of issues. You have not only the COVID crisis that is locking down small, medium enterprises, where you need to have at the national level a number of relief packages, essentially, whether it be direct or through financial institutions. But the other side of this is pre-COVID, we had a slide in the, you know, the price of oil. So a lot of oil exporting economies that were experiencing a price slump that really caused a question mark for large foreign direct investment from big organizations to say the new price really is not going to work. So we were having these two things converge at the exact same time. And I think a big part of thinking about, well, what does this mean for economic opportunity in a lot of different countries, is to think of other ways of shifting the economies, whether it be in the understanding that Western markets are going to be thinking about their own local economies and repatriating supply chains for some light manufacturing. That means some of the places that we're anticipating that globalization would have brought that light manufacturing capacity into the country where they would have had jobs, that's going to shift, where we need to ask ourselves, domestic consumption of some of those goods needs to be a key target place in regional economies in particular. And so we're going to find, especially around the renewable energy space, areas. And so, the Ethiopian Renaissance Dam in particular, we've got to make sure those type of revenue share efforts in the region stand up and help prop up the productivity that's necessary.
All right. Thank you, Aaron. So, Dr. Zungrana, let me come to you. What about the impact of COVID-19 on other services? Dr. Umar mentioned it earlier. What is being done in Burkina Faso, or what can be done to help communities really care for themselves on other health issues and not be afraid of COVID?
Yeah, thank you so much. I have to reiterate that the impact of COVID on the health services was kind of huge, because at the beginning, the health provider was not well prepared. They fear taking care of client, and client also fear going to the health facility, because this is where they believe they may get the disease there. So, and the users of client for these services, like antenatal care services, malaria, TB, HIV/AIDS, was dropped a little bit according to some study. But currently, we are seeing that the government is making effort to build the capacity of the provider, but also equip them with personal protective equipment. But the most important thing is sensitization, community sensitization, where religious leaders, community leaders, all partners, stakeholders, it's like a national level stakeholder mobilization for everyone to play his part for COVID tackling. So I think they are trying to bring a kind of reassurance for people to continue using health facilities, but also for providers to be more confident and skilled to tackle this disease.
Okay.
I think apart from, yeah.
Okay, great. Now let's go to our viewers' next question. Let's take a look.
We heard that there is no vaccination for this virus, but some people talk about herbal remedy. So my question is, could COVID-19 be cured with traditional herbal treatment?
Professor Karisha, COVID-19 and herbal treatment, we've seen the controversy around it. What is your take?
So we have a new virus where we don't have a vaccine and we don't have any cures. So we're starting to see some promising products coming through. This week we heard about, from the recovery trial, the use of dexamethasone. We've also seen that hydrochloroquine makes very little impact. So whatever is out there, you know, people are looking at natural remedies, people are looking at drugs that may have been developed for other indications. But right now, they need to be evaluated before they can be used. So I would discourage people from just following what's in the news and in the internet as solutions, but watch the space in terms of good quality evidence, and based on that, utilize things. It's like every other new condition we have. There's always 100 people, if not more, with solutions. Okay. And people are so desperate, they will use it. And we need to be very cautious that we're using evidence-based interventions that we know work both for prevention and treatment.
Okay. Also, one of our Facebook followers from the Democratic Republic of Congo wrote to us saying, they say plant extracts such as quinine and artemisia that are used in pharmaceutical drugs are effective in conventional drug. Why are doctors so quick to rebuke solutions suggested by traditional practitioners who use herbal medicine? Dr. Uma, we've seen that with COVID organics, the Africa CDC very quickly raised awareness and said that people should be cautious. And there was a sense that this solution or this approach was not supported by the centers. What is your reaction?
Let's be clear. Africa CDC is very supportive of African therapies and possibilities for treatment. What we are also very clear about is that it must be evidence-based, it must be backed by very clear science, and it must be safe. If none of these have been proven, then we wouldn't be able to support that, because we don't want to be in a situation where we are providing support to therapies that may be able to cause harm. It must be safe and it must be efficacious. If it does not meet these two criteria, then as Africa CDC, we are not able to support it. Having said that, let me be clear that we support locally produced solutions to any type of problem, whether illness or otherwise. And there is every possibility that the next vaccine or the next therapy would be able to come from Africa. What we need to be careful about is safety and efficacy.
Okay. And speaking of efficacy, Dr. Jeremy Zungrana, Professor Karisha mentioned earlier hydroxychloroquine, saying that it has been proven not to be that effective. What is your take? There are doctors that are still using it on the continent. Doctors I've spoken to, whether it's in Burkina, in Cote d'Ivoire, in Algeria, they are still using this drug even after the WHO's said that it was not effective. What is your take?
I think this is, I will say this was part of, for example, Burkina treatment protocol, and this is what they have been using. And it is coupled with observational study, and still now we don't have a result. But what I can say is, as I mentioned, since almost the beginning, since May 25th, we don't have a single case of death. I don't know if this is attributed to the use of the hydrochloroquine or other related impact, but of course, if WHO and other bodies are saying that there is a risk, probably they have the basis and evidence for that. But for many African countries that I know and following, they are still using it, and they seem to have a kind of good result, but we don't know to which entity, is it this drug or other thing that we can attribute to it. I think it will be very interesting to explore what is contributing for Africa to not have a lot of death. Is it linked to the use of the hydrochloroquine or associated with other factors? And this will be a subject of study rather than just blocking thing. I wish if we have other alternative to propose to countries, they are ready to take on evidence-based as it has been always the case.
That'll be interesting to see, given that this is a drug that has been used for many, many years on the continent to treat malaria. Is it maybe because Africans are used to using it? I don't know. I'm just speculating. But let's go to another question from Faisal Jean-Pierre, who is in Yaoundé, Cameroon, a salesman. Take a look.
I have a preoccupation. I lost my activities and my business, and I would like to know how the government can help me.
And Eran Betrou, the informal sector makes up for over 80% of employment in sub-Saharan Africa. That's according to the International Labor Organization. So how can the informal sector be provided help, especially when we know that it's so difficult to track them?
Yeah, I mean, this is a problem not just on the continent, but kind of around the world, and even in the U.S. I believe African American-owned businesses, 94% of them are sole proprietors. So, in this context, there are a range of different activities, whether it be direct cash transfers in some places, but actually thinking about, well, what is the need that a number of these stakeholders have, a number of these individuals, it's being able to have the funds necessary to stay indoors, not have the ability to earn money, but provide the food that they need for their families and friends. And so direct relief for those individuals matters. But then recognizing that a couple of these, they're part of what I would call kind of, the first line response that's necessary to sustain the larger community. And so there are certain industries on the West African side that are taking recycling of plastics and melting them down and making new face guards. And they are essentially employing a number of informal collectors of recyclable goods to be able to have the supplies necessary to produce these goods that are then sold to the hospitals in the area. And so I look to the providers of capital, and I mean some of the loan funds that are focusing on the continent, to some of the microfinance institutions that are trying to figure out how to continue with their mission of providing access to capital, but also make sure that they're not unduly drawing themselves into a very risky lending that's happening. And here is where, at the national level, as well as philanthropy, can play a part in making sure that these conduits, these microfinance institutions, are well capitalized with both the liquidity that they need, but the guarantee in terms of their balance sheet to provide the financial assistance that some of these informal economy folks that are running around selling the essential items, foodware, as well as other things. So that's a critical part of making sure that they maintain that.
Okay. And I wanted us to talk about the way forward. What are some of the steps that we will take? And I want us to take a look at a short clip that we have from the former president of Mauritius. She spoke on the successes of Mauritius, at least what were some of the steps that were taken for the country to be seen as one of a success story so when it comes to fighting COVID. Let's take a look.
I think, we just adhered to what has been prescribed internationally when the first cases were detected early March. And there has been lockdown of the airspace, and the people coming in, they were quarantined. And because we have a free healthcare, so access to medicine was not an issue. And so we have adhered to the best practices all along. And people also have been quite disciplined, I must say. And when people have not listened to it, I think the police has been there to actually ensure law and order and make sure that the guidelines were respected. So it was a kind of triangular kind of approach, and it was very much the carrot and the stick approach.
Dr. Uma, the carrot and the stick approach in Mauritius, what is your take on what worked in Mauritius? What can we learn from the country?
I think the former president has explained very well what they have done and what has worked for Mauritius. The fact that it is an island makes it a lot easier to control the borders. The rest of Africa is a bit different, particularly the countries on the main on the mainland. Some of the things that need to be done is personal discipline. I like saying that we are the vaccine. It is what we do that is going to interrupt the transmission. Second, in terms of the next steps, we must strengthen our health systems, and not just hospitals and infrastructure, but also the numbers and the capacity of the healthcare workers need to be improved so that we are ready for the next pandemic when it comes. And finally, we must be able to provide correct and timely information to members of the public. That way they know what they need to do, when they need to do it, and that discipline is what is going to ensure that we can be able to tackle any type of illness that will be seen within the population. Personal discipline and improving the health system through infrastructure and capacity building for health workers.
Okay, and Dr. Karisha, from an epidemist perspective, moving forward, what do you see as some of the priorities or maybe some of your concerns?
So I think we all have to learn to live with the virus, and we have to be able to balance the public health imperatives in terms of slowing down the spread of the virus with protecting livelihoods and also respecting the rights of individuals. And I think we've seen a lot of police brutality in some of our countries, and we have to address that as we think about saving lives and saving livelihoods. But the key issue, I think, is what we just heard, which is that we have to move away from anxiety. And I think a lot of the early images was about deaths. And so as we ease the lockdown and return to the to being active citizens in whatever form and shape that that takes, we have to take the measures, the non-pharmaceutical interventions, the social distancing, the hand sanitization, et cetera, that we've heard about, mask using, because that's the thing that's going to help us and give us agency during this period of anxiety.
Okay. And Dr. Jeremy Zungrana, what social safety nets can help mitigate the pandemic as we move forward? Are we yet to see the worst case, or what can we do to avoid it?
I think one thing that I realized in COVID is teaching us is this is a multi-sectorial approach that we need to consider and shouldn't be only a matter of Minister of Health as it used to be. Everyone needs to be involved and to be part of it so that they can educate the people, because the perception that they will be giving to the COVID impact on the behavior of people, not only in terms of respecting instruction, but also committing to support or invest on what need to do. I have to say that COVID mentioned and show us that if you have a poor health system, you may end up being a client of this poor health system. So we should get prepared and get ready at any time.
Okay. And Aaron Betru, quickly, could you speak briefly about some of the shifty trends and global trends that can help or might help the recovery process? And also, what do people consider is the global capital markets can play during this crisis? What role can that play quickly?
Yeah, sure. No, I think a big part of this on the capital market side is we saw at the beginning of this year a lot of investors pull out of emerging markets for fear of what was going to be an anticipated decline. And as a result, a lot pulled out of Africa. But when you look at the projected declines globally, the contribution that Africa's decline has on the global decline is actually much less so than the other regions. So in terms of resilience on the economy front, Africa so far isn't as hard hit as other areas, knocking on wood, hopefully that this maintains. And so you have a number of investors sitting on a lot of liquidity, and they may be coming back in as they see the results of what are the efforts of the African CDC and others to kind of slow down the process. So that's one thing. And then on the second side, you've got a number of debt obligations at the country level. And sure enough, whether it be efforts by the IMF and other G20 countries to reduce the debt burden on African countries, we have to make sure that some of these processes are quite transparent. And what I mean by that is there's been reports essentially of whether it's bilateral activity of Chinese and African nations in terms of how those things are negotiated. The last thing that we want is at the end of this crisis to find out that these countries, due to their debt obligations, and there's quite a bit of Chinese debt in African countries, that they're made even more vulnerable. So transparency in that process is critical. And the third thing that I'll mention is the last large global recession that occurred was due to the 2008 financial crisis. And as a result of that, the Basel Committee created a number of macroprudential risk management financial regulations. And now I think going forward, we need to look back at those and tweak some of those regulations to encourage investment to come back into emerging markets, because we need that growth more than ever. And investors around the areas around, especially ESG related, should be encouraged, because this is the time to make sure that those economies grow back, but grow back better.
Okay. So much to talk about on the economic front, and we'll come back to that. Now, Dr. Ogwel-Umah, to you, Africa CDC's priorities moving forward, what should we look forward to?
Several things. First is building our continental capacity for disease intelligence, for local production of the equipment and supplies that we need, and for improving the capacity of our health workers and our health systems to be able to handle whatever a disease condition may be able to come. Second is to get commitments from the highest levels of policymaking that a new public health order is required for Africa to be able to adequately tackle any outbreaks that may be able to come in the future. And third is for members of the public to see themselves as part of the health system. That way, whenever there is need for them to act in certain ways that are public health appropriate, then they do so. And that way we can be able to bring to a close any sort of outbreak relatively quickly.
Fantastic. And thank you so much. Are you hopeful that we will not see the dramatic prediction that we've heard from experts that Africa will be the next epicenter catastrophe very quickly?
Africa is already showing them that there is no catastrophic numbers. Good things do come out of Africa, and COVID-19 is proving that. We are very happy with what we are seeing.
Okay, great, Dr. Umah, thank you so much. And the final word to you, Professor Karesha. This epidemic, can we talk about the aftermath? Is it too ambitious? Because there's so much that we still don't know.
That's true, but I do think that there are some amazing opportunities that come up, and I wanted to flag a few things that that relate to gender in particular and young women. And so the first, before I move to the gender issue, is that Africa has to lead some of the innovations in terms of diagnostic kits and tests, in terms of vaccines, in terms of new therapeutics, because all brand new, we're all learning, and this is the first opportunity we have to not just be recipients and imbibe what comes from somewhere else, but to actually be part of the solution.
That was a special edition of Straight Talk Africa on addressing COVID-19 in Africa and the way forward. For the latest news and coverage on the coronavirus pandemic, visit voanews.com. Check us out at facebook.com/VOA Health Chat, and let's keep the conversation going. Thank you all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Lino Mudu in Washington, with producer Dan Brown. Until next time, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.